Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 106 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crowe, that's Crowe with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. Listen to us every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on PRN.fm, or download us after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast programs. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. If you would like to sponsor the show as an individual or an advertiser, please contact me. Above all, thank you for listening. And now to today's guest. Alison Wolfe is a British author, academic, and journalist who has also lived and worked in the United States. She runs a public management master's program at King's College in London, but also presents programs for BBC Radio 4 and writes widely for national newspapers and magazines. Today we will talk about her 2013 book, The XX Factor. She says it was born of a sudden realization. People kept talking about women as though we all had vast amounts in common, but this is completely wrong. The arrival on the planet of 70 million graduate professional women has changed our societies from top to bottom in ways we are only just starting to understand. Today's professional women are historically unique, and this book is about them. Since I'm one of them, it's also about my and my generation's lives. But it's also about the differences between these 70 million and other women and the widening gulf that spells the end of sisterhood. Welcome to the show, Alison.
Thank you very much for inviting me to come on it.
Yes. Well, I wanted to start by reading the subtitle on the cover of the book, which says, How the Rise of Working Women Has Created a Far Less Equal World, which is a little bit provocative. So how has the rise of working women, women like you, created a less equal world?
One of the ways is in a sense, it's just kind of logical, which is that in the past, women had very, very equal incomes, as in they mostly had no income at all. And if they did, it was because they belonged to the poor working classes and were taking in washing or cleaning houses or putting coal in Victorian fireplaces or working in mills. But what has happened in the last 30 to 40 years is that professional women have started to earn very much on a par with men, except for the very, very, very top. So it's that notorious, not even the top 1%, that top 0.5% is still pretty male. But women have started to earn a lot more. So that means that women as a group have become much less equal. And that was bound to happen the minute that some of them started to make decent money. But the other thing that has happened is that we've had a big rise in what sociologists call assortative mating, which means you mate and marry with somebody who's like you. And so you've also got the emergence of these very affluent, highly educated married pairs, and they are actually mostly married among the highly educated. And that means you've got two good salaries coming in, two
right.
highly educated people. And they kind of increasingly dominate things. And at the other end, there's also, of course, a big increased demand for people doing very low-income jobs who actually service those families. And it's sometimes people actually in their homes, but it's also the fact that there's this huge army of people who are preparing ready meals, working behind the scenes at restaurants
yeah.
where people eat out, so all of that stuff.
Oh, can I read? It was a letter in a Canadian newspaper this morning, and it, in the business section it said, I was quite pleased last month when I attended the annual shareholders' meetings of Pizza Pizza, which is a Toronto-based pizza chain, as you might have guessed, to see the latest appointment brought that company's board to male-female parity, including its chairperson who conducted the meeting. In an industry that's so heavily skewed to female employment, there's no reason not to have such board composition at all such companies. Then it goes on to say, but don't stop at boards. The situation is just as appalling in senior management ranks. But it doesn't say anything about whether the addition of women at the top is going to make life better for the women at the bottom.
It would be lovely to think it would, but there's absolutely no reason whatsoever to think that it will. Yeah, I've also had people say, well, you know, it's really, really good. There are loads of women employees, so it's outrageous that members of the board aren't at least half female. The reality is the sort of women who become members of the board of a company like that are extremely unlikely to have been spending much of their working lives toiling in the depths of it. And the country that has gone the furthest with running a kind of natural experiment on this is Norway, where they mandated that a significant number, about 40% of board members, should be female. And they have produced this new creature called a golden skirt. And a golden skirt is somebody who is female, wears a skirt, very good at boards, lots of experience, tends to mop up a large number of non-exec directorships. And Norwegian and other academics have been studying this phenomenon like crazy, because that's what academics do when offered something like this. And I regret to say there is no evidence that it has any impact whatsoever on the pay or promotion prospects of women further down the company.
Well, I mean,
why should it?
Yeah, I mean, I think of Margaret Thatcher, who was hardly a friend to the working people. And, you know, I believe she was the first woman prime minister in England. But a lot of people's lives got a lot worse under her. But, I mean, there's also a lot of women who've done wonderful things as well. So I'm not saying women can't do that, but it seems like the system turns you into a certain type of person. And if you're at the top of, say, Goldman Sachs, you're probably very focused on the profits of Goldman Sachs and not on whether you're stealing the pensions of little old ladies.
I think that's right. I mean, you to get to the top of a particular type of organization, you have to be a particular type of person. And okay, it's true that sometimes being a female can help. And actually, Margaret Thatcher always said that one reason she got a foothold in the cabinet was because they were so desperately short of women. But I mean, absolutely, she had no particular interest in promoting people because they were female. She was very firmly of the sort of the free market, you know, do it by your own bootstraps persuasion. And generally, all around the world, I mean, I think back in the 1960s, there was this sort of rather strange, naive belief among many feminists that women politicians would be softer and gentler and different. But, you know, you start working through the female politicians of this world. I mean, Margaret Thatcher, but also Indira Gandhi. Angela Merkel is in my view, a remarkable politician, but not in any sense, obviously, terribly female.
I don't think that there are too many Greeks who are thinking, well, it's good that we have a woman in charge of our economic situation.
I don't think so either. And, you know, today, for example, Rome has just elected a female mayor. But I think that it's very much a protest against the government. I mean, really, I don't think her gender has anything to do with it, and she isn't where she is because she's female. So,
no, I mean, she's part of the Cinque Stelle movement, right? Which is is run by Beppo Grillo, or
yeah, exactly, precisely.
Yeah, so she may be a very good mayor. She may be exactly what Rome needs, but I think the Cinque Stelle won several cities, and some of those may have been won by men, and they're presumably going to have similar policies.
They're going to have similar policies, and they are Cinque Stelle first and men or women second. And in some ways, of course, that's wonderful. That's just how it should be. But it does mean that this idea that holding certain highly paid positions for women is going to be good for anybody other than the women who get them seems to me to be at best unproven.
Right. I mean, I could think of some policies that would benefit women at the bottom, like a minimum wage increase, subsidized child care, you know, more flexible days off when a child is sick, maternity leave, accommodations for breastfeeding mothers, things like that. Those would make life better for somebody working at Walmart or something like that. But I hear a lot more talk about we need to get the boards at equity. We need to get the parliament at equity.
I do too, and that is very much what is pushed, I'm afraid, by the media elite female columnists. I mean, they are obsessed with boards. They're obsessed with the number of women at the very top. Here in this country, we have all female lists for certain parliamentary seats, but from the Labour Party.
Right.
I actually think that's... I cannot understand why replacing a Yale or or maybe in your case, Toronto-educated male with a Yale or Toronto or Oxford-educated female is a huge step forward in terms of equality and social progress. I don't want to overdo this. It's fantastic that able women can now make careers, but we shouldn't expect that putting a woman on the board is good for women any more than putting a man on the board is good for men. Why would it be?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you can describe some of the changes that have happened with women working, but women at all levels are working outside. We shouldn't use the word work because women have always worked, but women are being paid to work outside the house in a much greater variety of jobs. I mean, even when I was a kid, there were very few women doctors, vets, things like that. And now many graduating schools of doctors, vets, lawyers are at least 50%
women. At least 50%, and in many cases more than 50%. And of course, you know, this is a revolution, and you're absolutely right. I mean, it's sort of really started to take off in the 1970s. That was something I hadn't actually quite realized until I started actually looking at the figures, because you know it's kind of like a fish doesn't notice the water it's swimming in. And because I was of a generation which was educated to believe that we actually could do any job, it really was, nothing was closed, I sort of hadn't realized how recent it was. And again, you know, I don't want to come over as belittling the efforts of all these extraordinary women who fought for women's rights and all the rest of it. But these days, actually, the world isn't like that. You don't need to be extraordinary to be a female doctor. You can just be ordinarily bright and interested in medicine. And half the professional jobs in developed countries are already held by women. And it distresses me how much we are as a society both obsessed with women in very top positions, and commensurately how little we seem to care about how many of the very badly paid jobs are also held by women.
Right. One thing that is, I think, still true, and I know Bernie Sanders has, I've seen tweets from him, I don't know, 20 times on this, is that women get paid 80 cents to the dollar. And you had some interesting things to say about a comparison between Holland and Sweden, the wage gap, part-time and full-time work. So can you briefly describe what you found there? And
what you find is that very, very often cited figure does not mean that a female doctor doing the same job as a male doctor is paid 80 cents of the dollar. She isn't. She's paid exactly the same. In fact, if you look at people in their 20s, the average pay for full-time workers these days tends to be slightly higher for women. What happens is that a huge number of women are doing part-time jobs. Now, sometimes that's really by choice. And Holland is the sort of the poster girl, if you like, for this, because the combination of their sort of benefits, pension policies, and their labor market means that a huge proportion of Dutch women work part-time, and in many cases, they work part-time by active choice. And they can still get enough money that they want to. In Sweden, curiously enough, you find that working mothers are under more stress than anywhere else in Europe, because effectively it's the other way around. Sweden makes it very easy to go to work, but you basically have to go to work full time. That's what everything is geared up to doing. And you can't make enough money for it to be worth it if you don't go full time, and all the sort of everything is kind of geared to that. And so finding part-time work in Sweden is really, really hard. And all the kind of daycare and everything that we all think, oh my gosh, it's utopia in Sweden, that's for full-time working mothers.
You also said the United States is somewhat similar because a lot of people don't get decent health care
unless
they have a full-time job.
I remember being really puzzled when I first realized how few people in the United States work part-time compared to elsewhere. And then exactly, I had this sudden realization, but hey, it's the health care. So what the problem for women is that part-time work is usually less well paid. It's less well paid for a whole variety of reasons. It's the sorts of jobs where you can get part-time work. It's the fact that you haven't been in the workplace for as long. You don't have seniority. It's the fact that a lot of people are really desperate to get part-time work, so they'll accept something that's at a lower wage. And the problem is that's where the wage gap opens up. It opens up because women are far more likely to be in part-time jobs, and also because they're far more likely to have periods right out of the labor force. But the trouble is that it's not clear what you do about this. Not really, because the reason they want to be part-time, the reason they come out of the workforce is because they want to look after their, not just their tiny children, they want to have time for their older children. They are still the people who take the first responsibility for aged parents, all of this. And the interesting thing is that, you know, up to a degree you can try and say, well, the state will do it all. But first, that's phenomenally expensive. And secondly, as the Swedes have found, it's actually not a magic solution, because you do end up with an awful lot of kind of paying each other to look after each other and a lot of highly stressed people. And a very large proportion of the jobs that women do in Sweden are very low paid.
Wouldn't it be nice if we could measure happiness, you know, so that we could look at men and women?
It would be nice if we could measure happiness. And I suspect if we could measure happiness, there are all sorts of sort of attempts to do this, and you discover that having more money does make a difference and so on. But of course, what you actually also discover, it's hard to measure, but what we do know is that the people who are happiest tend to be the people who have families and children and spouses and kind of all these things for which more women than men actually choose to go part-time. So I think this is a really hard one to solve.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem with statistics is that we tend to go for the easier statistics, and the wage gap is a really simple statistic to understand. But if you try to measure happiness, of course, there's like 1,000 different ways to do it. And
men have a much higher suicide rate than women. I don't know what you conclude from that. Maybe they're just more effective at
Well, there's also a higher murder rate in men, than women as well. But I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there's some relationships where the man is doing better, is happier than the woman, and vice versa. And some women like to work a lot. I think it's a matter of choice. But the question is,
I think it's a matter of choice. But I think we have become incredibly hung up on this. Oh, it's outrageous. Look at this wage gap. Well, some of it is because of structural problems that are real structural problems. But it actually isn't because of outright discrimination. Once upon a time, it was. Mm-hmm. Once upon a time, it really was the case that you took a man and a woman doing the same job, the woman got paid less. And these days, that is not the problem.
And there were jobs that women just weren't allowed to do.
They
I don't know when the first women policemen were and things like that. I mean, it was okay for a woman to be a nurse, but not a policeman. And now it goes both ways, although I think there's still a big gender imbalance, which...
I think there are, and there are a lot of jobs which are heavily female and heavily male. They're not professional jobs, but there are a load of jobs at the below the professional level where they tend to be what people would say, they're very gendered. They're mostly women or they're mostly men. But you're absolutely right. It's not that long ago that there were jobs where people just said, oh, well, you know, women will never do them. Only they did.
I think at one point, secretaries was a totally male job, and I grew up in an era where... I just assumed that only women were allowed to be secretaries.
And now none of us get a secretary at all unless
we're really
senior, at which point they're a PA.
Exactly. They give you a laptop, and it's like, secretary, what on earth? You're not important enough for that, that's for sure. You said some interesting things about volunteering, because especially in the middle class, 50, 75 years ago, women would get married, would not work, And they would have help around the house, maybe a little bit of help, and they would have a lot of time on their hands. And so a lot of volunteer charities were based on the time donated by women, and that's gone away.
I think that has gone away totally. In fact, one of the things that's quite interesting is I was talking to a friend of mine, actually, who's just literally this last weekend, and she had decided to sell her business, and she thought, I'll give a lot of time as a volunteer to charities. And what she discovered is that actually charities these days don't know what to do with volunteers except put them on their boards, because they have become organizations that employ people. And that, of course, is a response to the fact that the old style volunteer has vanished. And we were actually talking about this and about the fact that this is, again, it's a mixed blessing. It used to be that for a lot of women, they did volunteer work, partly because they truthfully believed that they wanted to give something back, and partly because they needed an outlet for their energy. And a lot of these women volunteers used to be sneered at, you know, criticized as Lady Bountifuls, and the sense was that this was not appropriate, and basically people oughtn't to have to ask for charity anyway, they ought to have entitlements. And I think we've sort of come full circle. We've discovered that actually you can't do everything through the state. At the end of the day, it's charities that almost always notice an unmet need. And
I mean, it's the opposite is true, too. I mean, America tries to download everything onto charities, even when it's totally inappropriate because it's too big a job. But it does go both ways. I agree that charities play an important role.
And now we sort of have a situation in which, essentially, middle-class women don't do it anymore. Now, that's because they're all at work. It is actually quite depressing, because one of the other things that I hoped I would find is that when people retired, they would all suddenly start doing lots of charitable work. But I don't know about America, which is kind of more philanthropic, maybe because the government does much less. But basically, people don't. You have these sort of feel-good things like, oh, we all volunteer. When you look at the small print, we don't, not really.
I do have two friends who are retired who work for the food bank, which they're genuinely doing it because they want to help, and it's a need. I really question why our society needs a food bank. You know, why there's so many people who can't put at least food on the table and a roof over their heads. Like, that seems like something we have to do. But it seems like retirees are filling the gap, because now they're still relatively young. They're not necessarily 65 yet, and they're healthy, and they don't need to...
Well, some of them, like your friends, do fill the gap. But when you actually look at national studies of how much time, on average, people spend, including retirees, volunteering a week, you're talking about minutes, not days.
Yeah, I think that probably is true. Like, people might, for most people, I think people might do a walk in the year for a charity. They might volunteer
exactly.
for a day.
I have to plead guilty. I mean, you raise money and you do something which is demanding and fun, and yes, you raise some money, but it's not quite like those generations of women who actually spent huge amounts of time. Now, you know, again, it had a dark side as well as a light side. I mean, I'm sure many of them were sort of quite sort of Lady Bountiful about it. But a lot of them, including people of my mother's generation, they were amazing. They got things started, they got things done, they gave absolutely huge amounts of time and energy and organization and friendliness, and that is all gone.
Yeah, I mean, it is a real adjustment, and those are all characteristics that can easily be translated into the working world. Mm-hmm. But they weren't allowed to work, and now they are. Let's go on to the topic of marriage. You made some interesting comparisons or interesting observations about marriage between the more elites, say college graduates, versus the non-elites?
Yes, they have very, very different patterns in all sorts of ways. They, the graduates of this world, and this is all part of, you know, what you asked me about earlier, there's becoming a more unequal society. If you look at people who are full college graduates, full bachelor's degrees, and you look at what happens to them, I mean, first of all, they get married later, mm-hmm. and they have their children much later than the rest of society. And they also they're also much more likely to stay married. And as we know, you know, it's not that no child can manage from... of course, the world is full of amazing single mothers who bring up kids fantastically successfully, but it's also true that, on average, you're more likely to do well if you're in an intact family which can pay its bills than if you are a child of a struggling single mother who's very poor. So... again, it's this kind of this widening gap, because graduates tend to get married later, get married to each other, stay married, have their kids late, all of that. Whereas when you go to people who are educationally much less successful, they are much more likely to have children without getting married, and when they are in partnerships, these are much more likely to break up, and they have their children much younger. And these, again, I mean, the patterns are more or less extreme in different countries, and they differ again enormously, but that is basically the standard pattern, and it's the pattern whether you're looking at Sweden or the United States or Canada or the UK or wherever.
And you kind of describe college as the new stratification, that college-educated people tend to marry college-educated people, and you can understand why this, they've got more in common, they that kind of stuff, but it also means that there's this social division. If you just got a high school education, and so does your partner, you both together are going to be earning a lot less and have a lot less opportunities than before.
I think that's absolutely right. And again, I think one of the things that has happened is that, you know, class increasingly is more important than gender. I don't mean that gender doesn't matter. Of course it matters. But it's more, what is more important is your class. And when I was writing this book, I interviewed a whole load of people, but including interviewing a variety of young women who'd gone to really, really good colleges, really good schools in American terminology, and were sort of following careers. And I asked them a question. I mean, this relates back to my experience because I'm so much older than they are. When I was first working full-time as a professional woman, in those days there were fewer because I was this one of this lucky generation. We were on the cusp of the wave, and so, you know, we could do anything, but there weren't that many women in the office who were older than us. And there was a real sort of female solidarity. You kind of used to chat to the secretaries, who were mostly female. And I can remember we used to have kind of girls' nights out, which included the professional women and the secretaries. And I asked a number of these girls about this, these young women in their late 20s today, and they just sort of looked at me as if I was mad. Why would you do that?
Yeah.
So I thought it was sort of depressing.
Yes. Well, you made a comment that often in meetings women still will sit together. But
Yes, that is true.
I was thinking that, you know, if I was to walk into a meeting room and there's just a few people there, if I was to go sit down next to a woman that I didn't know, I would feel like, you know, it was almost like making a pass at her or something, right? So I would avoid sitting next to her.
Yes, I mean, absolutely you would. Either consciously or subconsciously, that's exactly what happens. And the same in reverse. So you walk into a room, and if it's full of people, particularly if you don't know them all, you go and sit by another woman. It's safer. It's not because you're going to be assaulted, but you don't want to be misinterpreted. And again, it's quite subconscious.
Yeah, and I mean, there are guys that do love to try to chat up every new woman. That was that famous thing.
There are fewer and fewer. I mean, and not just because I'm getting older.
Well, there was that. I don't know if you heard of this. There was this big fuss on LinkedIn where there was this older male married lawyer, and this young female lawyer, and he, you know, did a connect on LinkedIn, and he said something. It was pretty tacky, like, "You look really hot in that picture," or something like that, right?
And she descended on him with a sort of absolute...
I thought she just made it worse, because actually, if you really literally interpreted what he said, it wasn't that bad, but obviously for an older married man to be making that comment,
I mean, it was kind of stupid of him, but I do remember, and it was interesting because the comments were, I think they were even pretty evenly divided. She also got a lot of criticism.
Yeah, like I thought the best thing to do was he actually said the photo is really beautiful, and she should have said, "Oh, the photographer is so and so, and you know, if your wife and kids need a photographer sometime, you should check him out."
I know, like, but totally I still divert. Have to be staggered by the fact that he was kind of idiotic enough to do it.
Yeah, it was.
I mean, you wouldn't have done that, would you?
No, I would be very careful.
I was going to say, I asked a couple of my male acquaintances if they would have done that, and they looked at me as though, you know, are you mad?
Yes. No, I would be a lot more subtle for sure.
Absolutely right. And this sort of, so it's not that gender or indeed sex have gone away. But it is very different because, again, what is clearly the case, and you know, this is something that the first, the pioneering generations of women had to put up with. I mean, there's no question that if you were a a female in a largely male workforce in the past, I mean, often you were kind of fair game.
Right, right. Yes, I mean, there's the famous casting couch in the movie industry, and I don't think that was just a legend.
I don't think that was just a movie, no.
Yes, and, or just movies. You actually talked about the sex industry. I mean, one of the things you said is that there's now an increasing number of women. Well, I guess you said that it always has been this way. There's quite a few women at high positions in the sex industry who don't necessarily get there by rising through the ranks. In other words, they don't start as a porn actress or start as a prostitute. They might, like Christine Hefner, is that her name?
Yes, Christine Hefner, and actually just go in as businesswomen. Yeah, that's true. It's absolutely true. One of the curious things in this country is that one of the sort of the best respected businesswomen, who's sort of always there at award ceremonies, actually, she took over from her father a chain of failing sex shops and turned them into a huge success, partly seriously and partly kind of slightly tongue-in-cheek. And I'm 100% sure that she did not start her career in the sex industry. No, what is interesting is that is, again, it's a difference. I mean, because in the past, when women really had almost no opportunity to be anything except servants or wives, then essentially the sex industry was kind of what there was. That was pretty much the only thing you could work in.
And you're saying you're describing it, I guess it should be pretty obvious, as a pretty hierarchical industry. Like, even in prostitution, there is a drug addicted street prostitute who's desperate
Indeed.
To raise some money, and then you have the extremely high end, hundreds or thousands of dollars an hour call girls who are really living in a completely different world.
And they're completely different people. You know, the sex industry is obviously much less important for women as a career than it used to be, and a lot of the, yes, I mean, the drug addicted girls on the street are just light years away from anybody who's operating at the high end of the trade. That's perfectly true.
And is my last interview was kind of a completely different topic, was on Vincent Van Gogh, and the topic of prostitutes came up because he had real difficulties with relationships with women, and I think his brother also frequented prostitutes. But the person I was interviewing who'd written a biography said that, you know, in those days in the major cities, there were tens of thousands of prostitutes all over the place. I mean, has prostitution actually declined in terms of the
number of
people?
Well, the problem is it's always really hard to know, isn't it? Because these are not terribly reliable figures. But I've no idea how much more or less of it there is than, say, in the 1970s. But compared to any period before the Second World War, yes, it has. And my suspicion will be compared to any period before the pill and the sort of the sexual revolution of the 70s. Yes, it has.
I was wondering if the pill, you know, because if you think of like the 1800s, early 1900s, sex in a marriage meant maybe there's another child on the way,
Indeed.
Which might not be too desirable. So you could see there would be a motivation for married women to have less sex, or they just were going to get dumped
with
another child.
I think that's right. And I mean, again, the trouble is we, for obvious reasons, don't have exact numbers. But it's not just that unmarried men couldn't have sex with nice girls because the nice girl got pregnant, but it was also within marriage that there was a lot of stress associated. Because, you know, when you see highly romanticized historical films in which everybody's tumbling in and out of bed with each other, I'm sorry, it wasn't like that because you got pregnant.
Right.
And getting pregnant was just catastrophic, and there was no easy or legal abortion. So that meant that yes, absolutely, that brothels were just far more important and far more accepted and far more just kind of part of the scene. Now, America has had as in the United States, has been prone to moral panics and moral outrages. So they had a huge sort of white slavery, anti-prostitution kind of movement at the turn of the 1920s.
Well, that's actually kind of still going on. I mean, you mentioned you're a little skeptical about the claims of trafficking, and I wanted to talk about this because prostitution is always difficult for people to deal with. If you're if you're a feminist, you think it's exploitation of women. There are people who, you know, think the people in the sex industry have a right to do whatever they want, and it's a free market, etc. But the reality is, from what you described, that most of the women in the sex industry, whether they're porn actresses or whether they're amateurs, like you describe, you know, women taking off their tops for these websites that, like Girls Gone Wild or whatever, or prostitutes, most of them, you seem to be implying, were voluntarily in that position.
Well, I think, I mean, in the sense that very few of them have been sort of kidnapped and enslaved. Now, clearly, you suppose we take, which is quite common in Europe at the moment, you take girls who come from the countries of Eastern Europe which have been economically least successful. So, you know, there was a period when Russia was in really bad shape, when particularly, you know, the most gorgeous girls were sort of available in hotels frequented by Westerners, and they would come from all sorts of backgrounds because that was how you could make money. Now, obviously, you could say that this is, you know, it just means that you're just as much forced into it if there is nothing else that you can do as if you're actually literally enslaved. I actually think these are not quite the same thing. And in the sense that most of these women are not, in fact, kidnapped, enslaved.
I mean, if somebody's taken...
I think that's true. I mean, I don't mean there are no such cases.
Right.
But people try very hard to locate and find people who are, in some sense, enslaved and trafficked. And the reality is that although many of them may be doing it for reasons which are... which come out of family poverty...
Right.
Problems that is somewhat different from actually trafficking an enslaved female individual, and that really does not seem to be a major phenomenon.
Yeah, I mean, I think prostitution is often driven by economic forces. I mean, a drug addict is not a prostitute directly because of the drug addiction. It's because they need money.
They need the money, and you know, if you're a drug addict, you're not going to be holding down a well-paid regular job.
No, and so there's many places where it's not drug addiction, but just poverty. And even if you go around rounding these girls up and sending them home, if the poverty continues to exist, they're just going to come
back. And this is exactly what you get with prostitutes who come from other countries. Now, it is true that often they have been promised or think they're going to make far more money than they do. You don't, unless you're at the very top end. You know, it's not a job you'd want to do. But
yes,
that is different from saying that people are in any direct sense forced into it. And I suppose that's pretty much always been true. I mean, you were talking about we were talking about kind of how much more common it used to be. And what you had in just about every sort of mainland European town or city of any size was you would basically have a licensed brothel.
Right.
And that was just kind of where young men went. And they had, you know, the girls had health checks and all of this. Now, you know, this wasn't something that you dreamt of your daughter doing, but it was very clearly a way in which you could often make more money than doing the other jobs that were open to girls with little education and few family connections.
Well, yeah, I mean, even today, if you think of a country like Bangladesh, for example, I mean, what are your choices? There's the very unsafe garment factories, other kinds of manufacturing, and you know, prostitution may produce more money. And it's not going to go away. I mean, the demand will always be there, but I think it would go away if the economy gave people better jobs at the bottom end of the economy.
Yes, I think so. And again, I mean, the interesting thing is, obviously, this is hard to get data on. But again, one of the things we know is what you alluded to at the beginning, is that, you know, there's a huge price differential between one sort of prostitute and another sort of prostitute. One of the things which is sort of quite interesting, which was a point that was sort of made by, and then we should come back to another subject, I guess, because what I do want to emphasize is that these days the sex industry is only one among many, many, many places where women can work.
Yeah, I didn't want to obsess on it.
At the time, we really didn't have much option.
Yes.
But again, it's an interesting question. I mean, there are likely to be men, including sort of disabled men, for whom regular Hollywood-type, glossy, pick up in a bar sex is just not going to be a reality ever.
Yes.
So I don't think the demand is ever going to go away entirely. But I think the point I would want to make is, once upon a time, women had so few options. Mm-hmm. And the sex industry was always one of the very few places where actually you could be a businesswoman.
Right. And you also mentioned teaching, the importance of teaching.
Teaching was phenomenally important. And it's also, I think, quite interesting in terms of sort of shifting social patterns and kind of leading through to this point I was making about the present day, which is that, you know, people marry people like themselves. Teaching was the female profession. I mean, from the sort of the early 19th century on, the whole industrializing Western world started mass education.
In terms of a middle-class profession.
I mean, it meant that middle-class girls could earn their living, which they had not been able to do before.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There just was not any way you could earn your living respectably as a middle-class girl in the labor market. You could be helping in the family business, behind the family shop counter, all of that stuff. But there were no paid jobs for large numbers of middle-class girls, and suddenly there were.
Right.
And for generations, basically, if you were a bright middle-class girl, what did you do? You became a teacher.
But now, if you were super bright and ambitious,
if you were very ambitious, you might become a Wall Street lawyer, which would be a silly thing to do because you'd discover you were working 24-hour days and it was kind of hard to combine with any form of lifestyle. But you might also do something much more fun. You might become a doctor. You might become... you might go and work in a high-tech industry. You might work in television. You might work as a top-end tourist guide. You might manage a hotel or a restaurant. I mean, you name it, and we can do it.
Yeah, yeah, I think it's true. I think that's really good if, you know, if everybody was benefiting from these opportunities.
Well, which brings me kind of back to my sort of sour note, because, of course, that also comes with the people who actually make the pizza and deliver the pizza.
Yeah, well, it's like the letter that I was reading. I mean, the opposite, there was also another letter which said the opposite. It said, forcing a company to have a board with a certain number of individuals within a specific group only ensures that one group has an inherent advantage in obtaining certain positions. It may achieve equality, but is anything but fair. And I personally disagree with that because I think that white men have had an advantage for a long time. And if people were picked on their abilities, boards would be a lot more even. But I also think we're still talking about the board and we're not talking about the quality of life for the people working at the bottom rungs of the company.
Yeah, I mean, I think, in terms of actual effectiveness, what makes an effective board is kind of hard to figure out. As I said, there's certainly nothing to suggest that just putting more women from similar backgrounds on makes it a more effective or even a fairer board. I mean, I'm not sure I feel that if I got given a big rise tomorrow because I was a woman, would that in any real sense redress the injustices of all that were visited on all my grandmothers, great-great-great-grandmothers? I'm not so sure. But I think that in terms of what would make things more equal today, we're kind of in agreement, and the top priority is not the makeup of company boards.
Yeah, I mean, going back to that horrible fire in Bangladesh, and it wasn't the only one, but that's the reality for a lot of poor women in a country like Bangladesh, and they probably have preferentially hire women because they have smaller hands.
And they're better at it, and they tend to be... Yeah, they tend to be more reliable as employees often and all that sort of stuff. Exactly. And they've always been important in the garment industry. And I seem to remember there was that terrible fire on the Lower East Side of the United States. And
the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory.
Yeah, exactly.
Fire.
It was nearly all young women, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I think that's why a lot of these jobs employed children, because for something fine like thread, the children's hands are smaller and it's easier for them to work.
Yes, and that's
we're in a purely utilitarian world. That's what happens, right? You employ children because they're cheaper to employ, and their hands are small. Now, speaking of children, you did talk a little bit about these, what you might call these power couples. They're both earning huge salaries, but they're both also working really long hours.
Yes.
And they have one or two children. They don't have a lot of children. This reminds me a lot of the British aristocracy back in the 1800s, right? That you outsourced child rearing to the nanny.
They did indeed outsource child rearing. They had more children, but they definitely outsourced it. And that the interesting thing about, again, about modern parents is they outsource a lot of it to the nanny, but they also increasingly, they do actually spend a lot of time not just kind of being with their children as they go around sort of, you know, doing ordinary things, but very intense parenting. So you do improving and educational and recreational, and it'll go on your CV later kind of activities.
Right.
Very intense.
Yeah, it seems very structured. I mean, I think the lower, the middle classes spend a lot of time with their children, even though they're also working a lot, but it's like taking them to a baseball game, you know, taking them to baseball practice, to dance rehearsals, piano lessons, things like that. Whereas I'm sure at the elite level, everything is carefully calibrated. Like, how
and
is this?
A lot of it is. And then, of course, when you get further down still, there's even less directed activity. I mean, there was a study that just came out the other day in the UK where I live, about the amount of time that parents spend reading to preschool children, and the class differences are just gigantic.
Mm.
And of course, that means that when the kids start school, you've already got this huge gulf. Now, there were all sorts of the politicians said, oh, we've got to do something about parenting classes. Well, I mean, maybe you can do something about parenting classes, but
I think it's opportunities. Like my I have three children, and they were all reading before kindergarten because we sent them to a Montessori school, which cost quite a bit of money, but we you know, made it work. But that would not have been available if we hadn't been, you know, middle to upper middle class.
No, I mean, we've been struggling. I agree, and you know, I have to plead guilty in exactly the same way. And you know, everybody wants. It's kind of like everybody would like all children to be above average, but they'd like their children to be a long way above average because everybody wants the best for their children.
Yes.
So, but coming back to patterns, I mean, yes, you're absolutely right, and probably the best thing that the wealthy do for social mobility is just not have very many children.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, that in itself means there are some spaces.
Well, they have a lot more resources, and they're
divided.
They have
divided a lot more resources, but they don't actually reproduce themselves.
Right, right. One of the comments you made in your book, I think, was that nobody cooks anymore.
This is true. Well, except for me, I have to say.
Yeah,
I do cook, but I think it's a recreation.
Well, and we're coming towards the end of our time, and you told me that you had to cook.
I actually have to go and cook dinner.
Yes.
But this is absolutely choice, not necessity. It's my kind of unwind at the end of the day. I actually like cooking. I don't spend very long on cooking. I mean, that's the other thing that we know, that whereas people in the 1950s women spent, you know, many hours a day cooking. Even when modern educated or any women generally cook, as opposed to sort of, you know, going out, having stuff that comes in, they don't spend that long on it. But no, that's again one of the huge changes that, there is an enormous increase in the number of meals we eat outside the house.
Right.
And even when we eat inside the house, more and more of it is either stuff where we've had it delivered or stuff where we've bought it ready prepared. And, you know, I think if you are a London commuter, it's quite dramatic. And this would also be true in somewhere like Paris. I think less in the US cities, perhaps because they're just fewer rail commuters, but London stations are where you pick up a ready-made meal to take home on the train with you to stick in the microwave.
I still feel guilty about that. My mother, just even though she was a working woman, she raised three kids and she worked close to full time. A lot of that time, she always cooked, and I always feel guilty if I buy food out.
I mean, maybe that's also why I also still cook, but the statistics say that while she may not have been that much of an exception, by the time you get to 2016, if you're a full-time working woman and you are still cooking dinner every night, you're quite eccentric.
Well, yes. I went to buy some appliances a few years ago, and the first question they asked in the appliance store is this a kitchen you're going to be cooking in? What other kind is there? Well, I guess the other kind is it looks really good, but, you know, actually art isn't that useful.
Well, I did once stay in an apartment in New York, which was definitely the you don't cook in it side, because the minute you actually cooked anything on that on the cooker, the smoke alarms went off.
Oh, okay. And in Italy, it's the power goes out because you put
too
much load.
The power goes out because you were stupid enough to put the kettle and the toaster on at the same time.
Exactly.
Well, that's a whole other conversation.
Yes. Well, it's been delightful. I will let you go and cook dinner. I hope it's wonderful. And I will send you a link to the show when it's up very soon.
Thank you very much. And thank you again for asking me. I really enjoyed talking to you about it.
Okay. Goodbye, Allison.
Thanks. Bye.
My very progressive city councillor, who I like very much, tweeted, quote, 50% of women in Canada have experienced a violence since the age of 16, end quote. For some reason, the statistic grated on me, so I did a little digging. First of all, it's a statistic that's hard to understand, because a 16-year-old could only report incidents in less than 1 year, but an 86-year-old could report whether an incident of violence had occurred in 70 years. But the statistic also lumps together women who've experienced one incidence of violence in their entire life with those who've experienced violence every day, and it provides no comparative with men. I discovered from my city councillor that the statistic came from a 1993 Statistics Canada survey, but as far as I can find out, it's not available. She directed me to a website, CanadianWomen.org, which links to Statistics Canada, but Statistics Canada no longer seems to have the data. It has the questionnaire, it has a lot of information about the survey, but doesn't answer any of the questions that I have. I've asked both the Women's Organization and Statistics Canada if the data is available, but I haven't received a response yet. To be fair, it's only been about 1 day. If I do hear anything more, I will let you know in a future episode. Perhaps the biggest problem is that this statistic implies that violence against women is a significantly bigger problem than violence against men. I mean, after all, why would you say 50% of women in Canada have experienced violence if it wasn't significantly different than men? But the 1993 survey only interviewed women, and it only asked them about violence that originated from a man, not from a woman. And because the data is not available, even the definition of violence is not available, it probably includes things that might not be considered violence by all people, such as uttering threats, and may also include insults, such as calling a woman fat or a slut. The questionnaire did include questions on just those things. But really, I'm surprised, not that the rate's so high, but that it isn't 100% for both men and women. The statistic is, when you think about it, pretty meaningless. I've lived a life pretty free of violence, but even I can think of half a dozen incidents where I have experienced violence, mostly from men, but also from women. So I would contribute the same to the statistic if I was asked, which I wouldn't have been because I wasn't a woman, as someone who was beaten as a child and then ended up in an abusive relationship, experiencing thousands of incidents of violence throughout their life. My experience of rare incidences of violence and their experience of frequent violence would both be a one in the survey, and only people who said they'd never experienced violence from a man at any time since the age of 16 would have had a zero. What would be more meaningful would be to ask men and women how many incidents of violence they have experienced in the last week, month, or year, or some other time unit. This would quantify the data much better. And of course, the question should be asked of both men and women. It appears, actually, that the rates of violence against men and women, at least in Canada, are very similar. Even the women's group says, according to police, men and women in Canada are equally at risk of violent victimization. But then they add the rather strange however. However, men are much more likely to be assaulted by a stranger or someone from outside their family, while women are much more likely to be assaulted by someone they know. Why, however, does this mean that violence is not so serious when it comes from a stranger? I don't really understand why they had to add that. There is actually a survey, a Canadian survey, that's much more recent that shows that the picture is much more balanced and that in some ways the picture is worse for men. Measuring Violence Against Women, Statistical Trends, was published in 2013, although some of the data is a little bit older. It does include comparisons with violence against men. It's limited to only police-reported violence, so the numbers are much smaller than in the real totals, as most violent incidents and even some major ones are not reported. However, there's no evidence given that underreporting is different for men or women, or that there's any reason to believe this. And since the 1993 survey didn't ask men at all, it can't help. The report says, quote, women are at a slightly higher risk of being violently victimized than men. A rate of 1,207 female victims for every 100,000 women in the population, 5% higher than the rate of violence against men, which was 1,151 per 100,000. In other words, about 1.21% of Canadian women reported a violent incident to police in 2011, compared to 1.15% of men. Not surprisingly, women are much more likely to be victims of sexual assault and other sexual violence. Perhaps surprisingly, men are more likely to be robbed. The most serious of violent crimes, murder, is dramatically higher in men. Between 1971 and 2011, the murder rate of men fluctuated between about 30 and 50 per million in Canada, while among women, it fluctuated between 10 and 25 per million. It's also been declining faster over that time period in women than in men, which should be a cause for a small celebration, but I think advocacy groups just want bad news because it helps them raise more money, whatever their cause is. It is definitely true, I'll repeat once more, that sexually violent crimes are much higher amongst women, including murder. But the original statistic was just about violence against women, and the statistic by itself, because it was by itself, implied that it was significantly higher than the incidences of violence against men, which is just not true. Thank you for listening to episode 106 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter @infectiousmyth. Until next week, goodbye.